Okay.
First is first.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Thanks very much. It was awesome. I mean, I agreed with a lot of it for sure. There was a part when you started talking, you said, I perhaps didn't write down exactly what you said, but something about waiting, hanging on in a limbo, waiting to get a real job, right? That applies as well to think about like PhDs working as sessional instructors.
Absolutely.
In Canada and the
Absolutely.
US,
yeah.
Work teaching 10 courses a year and being told that they're basically unemployed or underemployed
yeah.
or underpaid for sure.
Well, what if Finland is 10% unemployment now, something like that?
So,
this is not just about
or like a 24-year-old
cities of the South. Yeah,
24-year-old in Southern California who now university grad who now drives Uber and manages Airbnb apartments
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for a living, right?
Yes.
So I get that. I get that precarious employment is a global phenomenon. I think it might help to start thinking about. More about today, there is a sense of like a global elite, a global middle class, and a global poor, I think. And they often have much more in common with each other, regardless of which countries they are, you know, quote-unquote citizens of, than they do with people from, quote-unquote, you know, a different group. Like, the global elite have less in common with the global middle class, I think, and the poor. So I get that, and I think that might be helpful as a way of thinking about these things. But I guess I kind of feel as if I felt a bit unsatisfied towards the end because I wanted a bit more. I get that people improvise. I get that people manage when they have to and that they always have. But don't we have the right to expect better? Don't people have the right to expect better, right? To expect those things. And what can we do about it? I mean, I feel as if how can we build more solidaristic economies where not so much that people should lose what they have. Like, you'd be aware of this as a tenured professor, how angry do people get at us, right? Because they think we're not working hard enough and the fact that we have benefits and jobs. And yet, that's not my problem. I want more people to have what I have. I don't think it makes sense for me to lose what I have. I think I want more people to have what I have. So how do we do that? How do we build more solidaristic economies? If it's not a fair question, then just tell me to shut up and I will.
It's a very fair question. And if we could create those good paying, secure jobs for everybody by calling for it, I would be standing right next to you calling for it. But I'm not sure that calling for it is accomplishing much today. And so I'm trying to think, are there other kinds of politics that are not the politics of labor, right? I'm not saying we should stop the politics of labor, that's not important. But it doesn't speak to the needs of a lot of people today, right? For whom the ability to exert leverage by withholding your labor doesn't count for much if your labor is not in demand, right? If you're one of 200 street hawkers selling the same damn product on the same damn street, and you threaten to go on strike one day, you know, capital is not quaking, right? So the question is, what other kinds of politics can we see here? And this is where I'm interested in the politics of distribution. The one that says not I'm entitled to more because I work a certain number of hours. I'm entitled to more because I am a co-owner of the whole damn thing, right? And I own it not by virtue of my labor, but by virtue of my membership in an ownership collectivity of some kind. That goes back to Kropotkin. I developed some of these ideas in the book. And I think there's another kind of radical politics there that is not so fixed on labor and the labor process as Marxism. There are other kinds of socialism that we have forgotten about that we need to go back to. And I think it's not a question of one replacing the other, but it is a question of finding, rather than waiting for the proletariat, right? Rather than waiting for that glorious day when the working masses of the world are all truly in solidarity, you know, that's getting a little old, right? So that's where I'm looking for sort of ascendant and emergent forms of politics. But I don't mean that to say, let's stop organizing workers or let's stop trying to raise working conditions. It's not at all a question of one against the other.
Hi, thanks very much, Jim. I've actually read the book and was convinced to a great extent. So you all will be also if you read the book. I'd like to the thing that troubled me toward the end of the book in the politics of redistribution is the way that it sort of stands on a rather old-fashioned state centricity and sort of a nationalism, that we rightful share in what? Okay, in Namibia, in South Africa, in, Alaska, but anyway, you know, there's so, and at the same time we are seeing, you know, I mean, there's two problems there. One is the sort of the decrease in the significance of conventional state structures and institutions and politics in a lot of ways for all kinds of reasons, you know, not, you know, global transfers of capital and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the other is the fact that, you know, a lot of the states where this kind of politics would be necessary are incredibly fragmented. And so the idea of not just having a state politics, but also that it sort of devolves to ethnic politics or other kinds of fragmentations in the state, which I think that you tip your hat to this at some point at the end of the book, but you don't really engage with it. And I was wondering if this would be whether you've thought about it more and you would like to say something about it now.
Yes, thank you. These are things that I'm continuing to think about. The cases that I discuss in the book of distributive politics and particularly of notions of rightful shares are very much organized around nation-state citizenship. And, you know, it's easy to see how that kind of claim can be made effective. It's not easy to do it, but it's easy to see how one would make that effective. There's a state apparatus there. It has a taxation mechanism. It has the capacity to send monthly payments to citizens in a remarkably effective and organized way. Not all states are like that. In fact, probably most states are not like that. So there's immediately a question, and you know, for those of us who've worked in other African countries, it's an acute question of to what extent are the kinds of programs of state-organized direct distribution expandable? I'm cautious in answering that because my strong sense would have been that they're not, they cannot be extended, that you can't do in Lesotho what you could do in South Africa, for instance. But I've been humbled by the fact that they have, in fact, done in Lesotho what they did in South Africa, in the sense that there are now old age pensions and child support grants in Lesotho. And they're smaller than they are in South Africa, but they made a huge difference. One of the things that points to is the fact that of all the things we ask states to do, handing out cash is actually one of the simpler ones, right? So you're not demanding as much state capacity as you would need for the old-fashioned welfare state, right? Which has to have elaborate informational resources and surveillance capabilities, and they have to know who works for which firm and how many years have they worked there and who you're married to and how many children do you have and what year were they born and what province were they born, right? All that stuff you need in order to have what we think of as a welfare state. If you have universal basic income, all you need to know is have you been paid this month or not, right? I don't need to know your name. I don't need to know your address. So in some ways, it's a more practicable kind of state program than most things we think of, including most development projects, right, which typically fail for similar reasons. That said, there's also, I think, the larger question of is the nation state even the right unit to be thinking about the problem of redistribution, right? Because, you know, you could go to Malawi and redistribute everything inside the entire country and everyone would be poor, right? So, you know, a lot of the basic income people like to think of it as something that ought to exist at a planetary rather than a nation state level, right? The main basic income coalition is called the Basic Income Earth Network. Right? How you would do that? I mean, again, the people think about this and not unintelligently. They think about things like Tobin tax or a mechanism of extracting a global tax through the creation of a global currency. Things like, I mean, technically, it's not impossible to think of ways of doing it. Politically, it's hard to imagine how you get to that point in the short or medium term. But I think it's a good thing to think about as a sort of long-term horizon, particularly at a time when the left has a hard time saying what we're in favor of. might be good to think a little more speculatively about what things we might be in favor of. And more practically, I think there is a sense in which norms about social protection have a kind of demonstration effect. This is why all the Southern African countries are running around trying to set up pensions, is because people see how effective it's been in South Africa, and then Namibia, and then Botswana, and then Lesotho, and then Swaziland. And you know, people are saying, well, you know, if they can do it, why can't we? And the IMF is actually working on what they call a worldwide social protection floor, which is to get some agreement that just like we expect every state that calls itself a state to provide free primary education to everybody, we should expect every state that calls itself a state to provide an income floor below which you can't fall. And put in those terms, it no longer sounds so utopian. It sounds like the kind of thing that one might actually get organized around. I'm also trying to think about this, the more complicated question, I think, that lies behind what you had to say, which is what we're looking for really something that takes the form of a membership group at all, right? Which is the traditional way of constructing state benefits of all kinds, but particularly welfare benefits, is to say there's a pool, there's a boundary around it, you're in. If you're in, you're a member, you get benefits. If you're out, you don't. In the conclusion to the book, I talk a little bit about this idea of presence, which is different than membership, right? Presence is those who are here. And I'm working on a paper right now that's more theoretical, that I tried to develop this idea of presence. That's right. What would it mean to think about presence, not at the face-to-face level, but at a kind of meta level? Because after all, societies used to be very literal things too, right? A society was like a group of people who got together and met. And now we've imaginatively constructed these vast things as societies, which have the properties of membership organizations. Can we imaginatively construct a kind of presence that would have the properties of the kind of face-to-face presence that allows foragers to say, who gets to share the meat? Whoever's here, right? Obviously. That's the current project I'm working on, but... The fact that I'm working on it is an admission that I didn't satisfactorily deal with it in the last chapter of the book.
I think we've got Vanessa.
So Vanessa from Iberoamericana in Mexico. I thought it was very, very provoking, your talk. Thank you for that. I'm an economist by deformation, so my questions will be more geared to that. Of course, there's many linkages to the economics of redistribution, and I'm wondering if you, and this is very linked to the question just before, and I'm wondering how much have you thought about the different types of states, not only politically, but also in terms of their economic basis, right?
Yes.
And I'm thinking about this mostly in this energy transition mode that where the big area of cheap oil has mostly finished, or at least has finished for many countries, in which they had a super surplus. So it was... At the beginning, at least Mexico, at the beginning was 20 towards 1, the difference between the... And now it's almost 1 to 1, no? Now it's really the government is suffering very strongly because most of their income for social projects and for... was based on that. So how do you actually balance or link this type of approach to an economy that can have a big surplus by... certain or an economy that is really redistributing between the entrepreneurships on clean tech and then these are giving kind of a tax, so more like the, maybe I don't know very much, but maybe the Finnish model, right? Mm-hmm. So that I think that would be a very, very interesting avenue to pursue.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't know if you already have some thoughts that you could share with
well,
us.
Well, I think... This is one of the areas where anthropologists can learn a lot from economists because we pay very little attention to the question of taxation, right? The anthropology of taxation hardly exists. And I think it's actually enormously important, particularly if you care about distributive matters. One of the reasons you can have the kind of programs I described in South Africa is because the South African state is a very good taxer. It's one thing they do well is collect revenue. That is extremely rare on the African continent. Most African states tax very, very ineffectively. they raise very little revenue, and they do it in arbitrary and capricious ways that undermines the legitimacy of the whole taxation system in the first place. So it's actually enormously important to have not just states that can do things, but to have states that can in particular do the thing which is called taxing. I also think that the issue about energy and the sort of energy transition that we're going through is really important. I mean, one of the things economists always say to me is that by far the best way to deal with carbon is to put a tax on it, right? And then market mechanisms will allow that to result in less carbon being consumed because we make it expensive to consume. And sort of critical lefties like me always say, yes, but that's very regressive because you're taxing something that everybody consumes and the poorest are going to have to suffer much more from that tax, like any kind of consumption tax. James Hansen had an interesting idea about that. He said, let's put a whopper of a carbon tax on and let's make it revenue neutral. That is, the government isn't going to get any money from that tax. We're going to remit it to the citizenry in the form of a basic income payment. Right, so all of that money that's collected from the carbon tax goes out in equal shares to the entire population of the state that's doing the taxing. That would have the effect of making carbon much more expensive and making people use less of it, but it would also be a real boon to the poor rather than being something. So, you know, the people are thinking about these things in interesting ways. How you get there politically, again, that's a real challenge. But we're going to do something about carbon, right? I mean, either that or we're not going to be around to talk about it in another couple of years. So.
About having enough cash in order to redistribute. So what is the model? What is the model behind that? And if you can really have that model within different models, right?
Yeah,
but
no, right.
there's many, but you have to have enough in order for so that's the tension. No,
the whole question of what's enough is the stake of politics.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
Because one of the first things that happens, we now know, when you start giving people direct payments, is they say, that's not enough, that's ridiculous, that's an insult, it should be double that. Right? So states are going to be under pressure to meet those kinds of distributive demands, and they're going to need to up their game when it comes to taxation to be able to do it.
One or two comments, one on the structure of moving from agricultural or feudal to industrial, but there's a large tertiary economy which is made up of information, which is made up of entertainment, which is made of sharing of information, whole kinds of exchanges in terms of banks and this, that, and the other. So there is a third ceiling, I would say. I've just flagged that. Then looking at transfers, the capacity of different countries to do even cash transfers, when you use the word universal, and when you target it to sending your children to school, not drawing them out, mm-hmm. having prenatal, postnatal.
The more conditions you add, the more complicated it is.
You add conditionalities.
That's right.
So
yep.
Bosa Familia has been successful with some conditionalities. Other African states have not been so successful. So the capacity is so variable. You know, capacity of many of the African states in terms of any kind of social transfers is very, very limited. Then you have in the world so much of violence, so populations flowing into Eritrea, going from Sudan to other places in Congo, etc. And even to give transfers to citizens is difficult. So where your suggestion of presence, that you're just present in that country, is very attractive, it's idealistic, it's romantic. Actually implementing it on the ground where you find it so difficult in developing economies to even give basic unemployment things to youth. What you would see if you look at social transfers across the developing world, you're more of old age pension, you have orphans, widows, but very few are giving employment dole. Very few, they just can't afford with more than 1 billion people in my country of India, very difficult to give a youth unemployment dole. The other is the whole aspect of doing or receiving without doing. So the Keynesian model, that if you make people do, if you make them, you know, people who have money have very large amounts of money to spend on luxury goods, on entertainment, on all the kinds of things. They can buy any number of clothes and labeled clothes and so on. So if we are in the area of selling, and just to give you one example, we have a little tribe in Gujarat which used to have a certain kind of stitch. It was called Jat stitch. And that stitch made a different set of clothes embroidered for a married woman, for an unmarried woman, and for a widow. And with a small, and it was sold to hippies. It hardly had much sale. We brought in, when I was working for the ILO, a designer from Paris. He said, "You're doing too much. It's too messy, you know. You reduce it, just do it on the cuffs, etc." And the same things were then selling at 6 times the prices. So this whole world of creating, selling, doing theater, music, you know, when people have lots of incomes, and some parts of the elite have lots of incomes to burn. So I think the third tier of exchange, so the agrarian, the industrial, and the exchange, offers possibilities. And also when you make people do something, whether it's singing or, you know, he feels that he's earning. But if you're just receiving without doing, it still may, you can make it a basic transfer of wealth, etc. But it's very difficult. And then the resources are very, very few to do that on a large scale.
Let me respond before I lose that. A lot of those were comments, which I thank you for. I won't try to respond to all of them. I'll just say that we shouldn't be too quick to suppose that presence is an unrealizable kind of principle for distribution. In some ways, it's much easier for me to find who's in this room than it is for me to find out what your nation-state citizenship is, right? They did a demobilization project in the Congo, trying to get people out of guerrilla armies. And they said, you know, if you turn in your weapon, we'll put you on a list where you get a payment every month. And they signed everybody up, and anybody who turned in their gun, also they took biometric markers on them. And then you come back every month, and you give your iris scan and your thumbprint, and if it matches, then you get your payment. And the principle was one that required you to know, in fact, very, very little about these people. And yet it was actually much less onerous in terms of capacity than a lot of kind of citizenship-based based principles. I think the new technologies of identification are have interesting possibilities here. We tend to, first of all, get alarmed at all the malign things that they could be used to do, but I think it's more interesting than that. I think I resist the idea that we're talking about people being given money instead of having them do things, because what's emerged out of the research that's been done about these social transfers, certainly in Southern Africa, is that people who have a little bit of money are actually enabled to do things. Right? They're rendered passive not by being given money, but by not having money. It's when you're really destitute that you're just stuck sitting in your little shack staring at the wall without being able to do anything. If you have that little bit of money, you have transport. You can go across town. You can go and visit your relatives. You can go and keep your social networks engaged. You can go and look for work. You can maybe, you know, buy some goods at the shop and bring them back and sell them in your... So there's a lot of possibilities of people being activated rather than rendered passive by these. And let's remember, they're very small amounts of money. Nobody's going to put their feet up and say, "I'm set now." I think, too, the Keynesian point for me is that it's poor people who really know how to spend money, right? Rich people accumulate it, but Keynes said, put the money in the hands of poor people and they'll actually create demand. And one of the things that the social grants in South Africa have done is to give people in poor rural areas and poor urban townships the ability to buy stuff. And so that creates markets. And if there are markets, then there's possibilities to start little businesses and so on. So there's a kind of really classic kind of Keynesian stimulation effect that you get from creating effective demand, I think. Yeah, okay.
Thank Thank you very much. I was very inspired about your idea of a work that is not this formal work. Yes. In Finland, we have had the discussion on prostitution like years now. Yes. Who's the criminal? Is it the one who sells sex or the one who buys? And this kind of gave me the idea that even though we speak for the women, that it's always, you know, for the sake of the women who has to do that terrible thing, we really don't consider that as a job. Mm-hmm. That's the... I just got this idea now that, holy moly, that's the thing.
Well, the idea of sex work is an attempt, yes. I think, to render it a kind of job, right? A kind of labor, at least. Yeah.
And since we put so much moral emphasis on our opinions that it's somehow wrong and it's not good, then we think that it's not work.
Yes.
But if we transform, if we change the way we think about work, then
suddenly things look different. Yes.
Yeah.
There's a historian named Louise White, Jeremy will know, who did something revolutionary in the social history of African cities by writing a history of prostitution that just treated it like you would do a history of any other occupational category, like you'd do a history of railway workers or something. Uh-huh. And she described how the industry got started and who were the first people who came and how they established themselves and what they did with... And it was really revelatory because you realize that all of the accounts up to then had been these very moralized accounts that were basically seeing this as a kind of vice or as a kind of degradation or something. And just to say, well, what if we treat sex work as labor? What if we treat people who enter into that industry as workers and look at their paths to accumulation and to permanent settlement and so on. It was quite eye-opening.
I have to read the book, definitely. Yeah. Then another thing you talked, your term was, I have to see, what was the... Anyway, you talked about the narratives and how the work is not as it used to be anymore, that people can find different ways of getting their livelihood.
Yes.
And it sounded to me that it's the narrative of entrepreneurship at the moment. We are listening the same stuff here all over again. Like the politicians are telling us that now you have to forget the regular jobs. Don't expect, do it yourself. Find, mm-hmm. use your social networks and go there and take advantage of the different situations and opportunities.
Yes, everybody's an entrepreneur, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not really happy with this. I don't know why, but I'm going to think this through and get back to you.
Well, it's a peculiar thing having decided that since all these people who are supposed to be workers can't be workers, let's just treat them as capitalists instead. it's wildly unrealistic, I think. They don't, in fact, occupy the position of entrepreneurs. They're not in a position to sort of accumulate via playing the role of capitalist. One of the things I say in the book is that the more interesting possibility is to say, if not, you know, think of Ricardo's three factors of production, right? Land, labor, and capital. Well, if they're not labor and they're not capital, maybe they can be landlords, right? And Bolsa Família, basic income in Brazil is known as renta básica, which means rent, basic rent. In the American tradition, Thomas Paine said that if the country really belongs to the people, then anybody who uses its land owes ground rent to the people, and everybody should get paid every year their share of the rent. So there are interesting possibilities here of invoking not the idea of the poor as capitalist, but of the poor as owner, that I think is actually more interesting and more promising. I also, a lot of what gets called entrepreneurship or service industry in African cities, I think actually has a very different kind of character. An example I give in the book is you stop at a red light, and a guy jumps up with a bucket full of dirty water and sloshes it on your windshield and wipes it around, and he hopes that you'll give him a little something before you drive away. Now, there's a certain kind of development policy document that would say he is a micro-entrepreneur, right? This is a small, medium, or what do they call it, small SMME. Small, medium, micro enterprises, right? There's a category for it. But in fact, he's not really selling a service. You don't really want him to dump that water on your windshield, right? What you really wish is he would go away. And if you give him a little bit of money, it's to make yourself feel better about the fact that you wish he would go away. What he's really doing is pressing a kind of distributive claim, right? He's saying, don't just drive past me as if I'm not here. I am here. I'm willing to put myself out for you. What are you willing to do for me, right? And I think those kinds of distributive claims are often very intimately bound up with things that might, at the surface, look like the vending of services or that sort of thing. This is why I'm so interested in sort of exposing the distributive dimension of even of things that aren't explicitly, right? Like a beggar is explicitly distributive. Please give me something. I want something from you. This is not explicitly distributive, but it's a kind of concealed or veiled idiom within which distributive claims are being pressed.
Thanks for your presentation. It was very interesting, especially because we are working pretty much on similar fields. When you say that people actually work, and I started thinking about the new government in Brazil that's actually saying, forget the crisis, work. And what I think
I'm the sorry, Brazil- they're saying forget?
Forget the crisis, work. That's one of the logos. I mean, what they are putting in the outside so that everybody read. And the fact is, I think they're forgetting that actually people do work.
Yes.
And whether they have very low paid jobs and they get money from the Bolsa Família or any other social assistance programs, they use this money to, I don't know, buy fruits and then make ice creams and sell at the beach, or to buy some kind of candy and go inside the buses and sell it to people. And therefore, I have two questions. One is, do you see this kind of improvisation coming from this money that's redistributed as the future, as you just started to note? And the second thing is actually a return of your question to myself while I was presenting. What about the undeserved people? I mean, the idea of people who do not deserve to get this money because they are simply doing nothing. I mean, do you address it as what you mentioned, the rightful share, or how do you actually see theoretical and practically this issue? Thank you.
Yeah. I want to be clear. It's not as if I'm looking at this world of people improvising and eking out a living in these insecure circumstances and calling for that to be our future, right? I mean, not that the world cares what I call for, but I'm not saying, gee, let's have a world where there's no permanent employment. It's not something that is a question of a choice. It's a question of a actual empirical circumstance that we have to come to terms with, I think. There's a whole bunch of people out there who don't have the kinds of jobs that I'm talking about and who have very little in the way of prospects of obtaining one. What are they going to do? They're not going to curl up and die and peacefully go off into a corner. And they're going to find other ways of making livelihoods. They're going to find other ways of making distributive claims, right? If you say, your labor's not worth anything anymore, they will find other things that they can use as the basis of making those claims. And maybe they'll claim to be indigenous, or maybe they'll claim to be stewards of the rainforest, or maybe they'll claim to be victims of a historical injustice, or maybe they will claim to be the original owners of all that gold and platinum, so why the hell are you stealing it from us? Right? People are ingenious and inventive and assertive. So that is a politics of distribution. It's not what I'm calling for. It's what I think is happening and requires us to analyze it. So the second question... I personally am not worried that people are going to take these kinds of transfers on the scale of Bolsa Família and, as you say, do nothing. It's a very small amount of money. I mean, you try to do nothing on the amounts you get in Bolsa Família. It's impossible. Yeah.
But that's what people are doing.
Yes.
They,
yes.
They,
No, that's right. Well, and the bourgeoisie has always sat there fat and well-fed on their porches and complained about how the working class doesn't work. So that's not news. I mean, whenever I see people accusing other people of not working, it's usually the hardest working people in the society who are being accused, right? I mean, I grew up in Southern California hearing about the lazy Mexicans. And the lazy Mexicans were picking all the food and cleaning all the houses and cutting all the lawns, and all the work that you saw going on all day long was being done by Mexicans, right? So I think one has to analyze that as a kind of ideology that rationalizes the very unequal distribution of work and particularly the kind of work that causes suffering. Yes.
Yeah. So for a very small, they tried this little experiment where they removed the conditionalities, right?
Yes.
But with a small number of people to see what mm-hmm. people would do if you actually removed them and continue to. And they found that people spent money on the exact same things that they were, food, yes. children's yes. fees. I mean, what else? So, I mean, that idea, I think, of the deserving poor, the undeserving poor, the fact that if you give people something that they'll run off and, I don't know, buy cocaine with it. I mean, it's not enough to buy cocaine with it. I mean, it's very much
we'll
about...
the revolution has arrived when
exactly,
the social dole is enough to buy cocaine with, right?
So that's much more about really middle-class prejudice and mythology about...
Yes.
About poor people, right? So,
yes.
Those conversations, I think we just need to let them go, the conversations about deserving and undeserving poor. I mean, they just go back, you know. I think they're very regressive even to have those
yes.
conversations,
yes.
right, today.
Even the World Bank says there's no reason to have conditionalities except that you need it politically to sell it to the middle class. Because the middle class wants
exactly.
to know, they shouldn't get something
exactly.
for nothing. We're giving that, what are they giving us, right? There has
That's
to be
exactly
a tit for tat.
You need it for that reason.
But in South Africa,
because,
they've been very strong on this.
Yeah.
They say, we don't want conditionality. South African parents want to send their kids
to
school.
School.
They want
yeah.
to send their kids to school more than they want to do anything else in life.
Exactly.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
this people keeping their kids out of school is not a problem. So why are we, making this?
And the other point that I wanted to make was about language. I do agree that you said, language is not just about us debating which term do we use. Do we call it the informal sector? Do we call it? I think there are real consequences to calling things, right? So. And there are consequences. I mean, this I've struggled with a lot. I mean, you call it the informal economy, and then that's it's probably the best term. But the others, for example, calling it the marginal economy is ridiculous. Sometimes it's 90% of a country's economy. It's not marginal at all. Calling it the unorganized sector, it's highly organized. I mean, we know that. So sometimes we attempt to put a positive spin on something. We attempt to valorize something with the intent of perhaps dignifying the occupation. But sometimes it doesn't have that outcome. Like, I remember when the Self-Employed Women's Association, with whom I've worked for a long time in India, they called themselves that because they wanted it to be dignifying for the women who do
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
work. But on the other hand, I think the meaning, you can read it as, when somebody tells me that they're self-employed, it sounds like they have a variety of options, but they've chosen to be.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Which
yes.
most women, I mean, actually, every single one of them, the women do it out of necessity. They're basically like, so now they're evolving a new language about survival entrepreneurship versus accumulation entrepreneurship, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I do think language is important, and not, yes, I mean, it's important because it's important just because, okay, you have the satisfaction of describing something the right way, but it does have real consequences, and that's how we really run into problems when you're describing someone who is, whatever, throwing water at your windshield as an entrepreneur.
I was working in Zambia during a time when the economy was really in free fall, and they were closing down mines, and people were losing their jobs, and these big mining cities were really on hard times. And so people that I had known had good jobs on the mines suddenly didn't. And so you would see people hanging around. But they'd buy a carton of cigarettes, and then they'd try to sell the cigarettes one at a time. Right.
Yeah.
This was a mine worker who had a good-paying, unionized job, was sending money back to people in the rural areas, was supporting a whole network of dependents. Suddenly he's out there with cigarettes. This was just when the informal economy literature was booming, and everyone was getting very excited about the informal economy creates all these new jobs every year. I thought, if that's creating a job, you know, what does losing a job look like, right? Because that, to me, looks like an unemployed mine worker. And so I think it's very important that we not allow, and I don't think it's a question of finding a different word for it. I think we should just stop using the category and try to be more precise. And, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is unemployment. Right? I was going back to the earlier keynote speech. I want to hold on to the idea of unemployment and to say people who are unemployed are not doing nothing. What they're doing is, in fact, very important. But let's not call it a job either.
Okay, thank you very much. I saw the relevance for my own study. I have studied youth in Addis Ababa. And I'm trying to, I mean, there's a lot of relevant issues you mentioned, but I'm trying to locate those youth, young guys who migrate to big city from rural areas, and they don't have any networks or social security networks. Mm-hmm. So basically, their life is like downwards spiral, what takes place. And they are basically supported by the other poor.
Yes.
So they can reside by the, I mean, they can sleep overnight in somebody's, you know, balcony or back of the house or something like that. So I'm just wondering that they are really facing the unemployment situation. But I also noticed that if they are given a small amount of money, they can really, you know, upgrade their situation. And so that was my first perplexing question. Another one is this authoritarian state that I find it a little bit difficult to for instance, in Ethiopian context, concerning this kind of rightful share concept.
Yes, these are all good points. I referred to some unemployed youth in another Ethiopian city in Daniel Maines' book, but they seem to have had more in the way of valuable social networks than the people you're talking about. They had relatives who could help them out. They had and the ones you describe have a bleaker outlook. It sounds like now they're struggling. But what you point to is very important, I think, which is these networks of mutual aid among the poor, even among the very poor, right? The only way people, in fact, keep it going is because even people who are themselves in very insecure circumstances find ways of spreading things around. We sometimes think of gifting and philanthropy and so on as things that are done by rich people on behalf of poor people. But all the studies I know out of Southern Africa show that the people who give the largest share of their income to other people are the poor people. Right? You have to. It's the only way you can survive is by engaging in these networks of reciprocity. Your final point raises the question of how does distributive politics proceed in a national political arena? And the examples that we've talked about most here, we've talked about South Africa and Brazil. These are both democracies, right? And they both got social transfers as part of a process of democratization. So I think that's not coincidental. I think the fact that poor people's opinions in some way matter in a multi-party electoral democracy is really important. It's a sure vote winner to say you're going to maintain or expand the social grants. No political party in South Africa has ever talked about getting rid of them. I think that matters. And authoritarian regimes, you know, that's a whole different game. I don't know, but my gut feeling is that probably democracy is a more fertile ground for distributive politics.
Who's next?
Was there another question?
Someone there?
Let me just
or a comment is fine.
Thank you so much for your talk. It was really quite amazing, actually. And but I was thinking about whether distribution. I'm from Nigeria, where we have no such you know, idea.
Right, but you have a lot of oil and a lot of poor people.
We have a lot of oil, and we have, like you said, you know, you need to have the capital to be able to distribute, and we should have the capital, but we don't distribute. So, what would be the approach or the kind of how would we convince whoever is in power to distribute? Is the idea to kind of reach a certain basic level of income for everyone that even you know, European countries are trying to do, or is it for wealth accumulation, or is it more like to make people more mobile, to give them something to work with so that they can figure it out on their own better? Or like, what is the how would we convince these complex states, in a sense, because it has to somehow go through the state, I suppose, this kind of idea, to do these. And then I was thinking about satisfaction. Again, like, what kind of approach would we need? Is it to improve people's lives? Do we need to go according to the happiness indexes or you know, to improve their self-satisfaction or life satisfaction? Because I remember as a bachelor's student in the Philippines, I did a study on women working as domestic helpers in rich people's houses, and our study was about satisfaction of these women. Yes. And somehow when you were speaking, I was thinking, what if these distributions were to improve, like, personal satisfaction? Because then we have to think about it in a different way, like, what the purpose is. And then it would be easier, perhaps, to at a national level or sub-regional level, figure out how to actually make it happen.
Yes. Well, the questions that I've tried to raise lead to what I've called a politics of distribution, right? They don't lead to a remedy. They don't lead to this is what we must do. They lead to a space of politics within which people will have different ideas of what we should do and have different ideas about what's possible and what's realistic and how much they're willing to pay and who should pay. And that's as it should be, right? All of that should be the stuff of politics nowadays. And it would be presumptuous of me to try to say, what Nigeria really ought to do is this, that, or the other, I think. You know, Nigerians have a pretty good idea of what they want to do with their country. The problems are practical and political. What I will say is, one of the things that I learned in the course of this research is how big a difference it makes to give poor people even tiny amounts of money. I mean, what you would think of as just ridiculous, insultingly small amounts of money, actually, in the lives of very poor people, is enormously significant. So even a small, what its opponents might dismiss as a tokenistic program, I think is worth paying a lot of attention to. The other thing is, I think what start out as very small programs can grow, right? And one of the things you do is you take people who've never expected anything but abuse and harassment from the state, and you turn them into legitimate claimants. And you turn them into people who have expectations that not only might they get something, they should get something, and they should get it on time. And before long, you get people not just becoming accustomed to getting social grants, but actually getting angry that they're not enough or that they have to stand in this line, and why is the government not doing what it's supposed to do? In other words, you get a more assertive citizenry and an assertive sense of citizenship. And so I think there's a political process that's set in motion with programs of direct distribution. We don't know where it will lead, but I think it's interesting and worth thinking about. It's also, I mean, the kind of, oh, but we couldn't possibly afford it excuse. You look at some of the countries that have afforded it, and then you come back and tell me, right? If Lesotho can have an old age pension, why can't Nigeria? Bolsa Familia, this very famous, very effective, you know, it's been widely studied, has had a major effect, apparently, on both poverty and inequality. It's something like 2% of GDP. I mean, it's not a massive slice of the overall pie. So.
Thank you very much, Professor. Yeah, I am probably going back. I'm somewhat old school when it comes to this problematic. My question to you is that what's the problem with production-based analysis on joblessness? And this is somehow related to what the other colleagues have already mentioned, because you know, I do political economy, and when I teach development, I actually highlight the production question, mm-hmm. that you have to create wealth first in order to redistribute. Because, you know, I come from the Philippines, and then I know about the third world, and every time they ask the question why most African countries are poor, or why poor countries are poor, they always problematize the question of redistribution. So I would always, for me, my argument is that it's actually, redistribution question is actually a production problem. And by production, I mean, you know, it's about, you know, how we create wealth to be redistributed, and how we also create value. Even here in Finland, for instance, it has, like, as you mentioned, a 10% unemployment. But at the same time, Finland is number one in terms of human capital. So the problem really is, you know, there's no more industries or economic activities or sectors that absorb there's no more demand for the kind of talents, skills that Finland has. It's the same thing also in many developing countries that even if, for instance, in the Philippines, that I always mention, that even if the government invests in education and human capital, if there's no demand for the kind of skills and education that we are creating, it will just feed immigration. People will just live elsewhere. So for me, I still have to be convinced that the first order problem that we have right now in understanding the jobless city is redistribution. I still go back to the production question, and I would probably still propose solution to think about, you know, an alternative mode of production or alternative production system. It may not go back anymore to what you mentioned about the Fordist paradigm, but there is some interesting economic dynamics that go through with the creation of the welfare state, for instance. Why, for instance, Germany was also able to feed and organize a decent life and dignified life for 80 million people. It's not anymore the old manufacturing industries, probably, but there's this so-called increasing returns mechanism that comes with this economic factor. So, you know, it's for me, I still think about the production problem first order.
We shouldn't stop thinking about production. And it's certainly the case that before you distribute anything, you have to produce it. The theoretical discussion of why I think we overvalue the productive and undervalue the distributive is something that I develop at length in the book, and I don't want to try to reproduce it here. But I'll just say, if you're interested in the question of the sort of theoretical conceptualization of the relation between production and distribution, and an argument that we should not think of distribution as secondary or derivative, you'll find it in the book. Let me just say, on a very broad scale, we produce plenty of stuff. The problem is not the production system. We produce massive stuff. We produce more than any of us need. I think the more acute problem is the distributive problem, which is that the massive productive capability of this massive global production apparatus we have is being distributed very, very unequally. And as a result, people are dying of preventable diseases, and you know, babies are being malnourished and all the rest. Producing more stuff is not necessarily going to change that. In Africa, every year per capita GDP goes up. African economies are growing rapidly. They're often mineral exporters. They're exporting more and more minerals. More and more money is coming from their mineral economy exports. But it doesn't go to the great masses of the population, all those people in Nigeria who see the oil go through the pipeline past their village and they never see a drop of it. I think I've also been influenced by watching the South African economy in particular since the transition from apartheid. And things like the gold industry, right? There was a lot of new investment in the gold industry, and the new investment enabled a shift to mechanized production, which made the gold production more efficient and made the gold companies more profitable, at least for a while. It also put hundreds of thousands of mine workers out of work, right? Because instead of going down with picks and shovels thousands of meters under the Earth's crust, they went to more open pit mining. They went to huge bulldozers. They increased the productivity of the industry, but in the process, that distributive mechanism that took a share of that productivity and delivered it into the hands of the workers was wiped out. The same thing happened in agriculture. Right? Agriculture has been just hemorrhaging jobs year after year after year in South Africa, and it's not because agriculture isn't productive. Agriculture is productive, but it's productive in a way that is giving fewer and fewer people distributive claims, right? Those labor-based distributive claims are no longer there. So I'm inclined, reflecting on that history, to pay a lot of attention to who gets distributive claims and on what basis is it possible to make distributive claims, and to be less concerned with, well, how many ounces of gold are we producing at the moment?
Thank you.
And thank you all.